Right. Tonight we want to wrap this study up, Nehemiah, the leader of God's people. And, you know, I hope this has been helpful to you. I hope, you know, one of the reasons I chose to go with Nehemiah, besides the fact that I felt like the points could be made so well from the book, is that it gives you something easy to go back to. When you go back, you know, through, as you go through your reading of the Bible, you go to Nehemiah, you see it. You know, if I just give you some points to remember, it's harder to remember them. But they're right there, and I hope you can hang your hat on that. Nehemiah was the man who came back and inspired, motivated, organized, supervised the rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem. And you remember he also was part of a spiritual renewal in the land. And when we come to chapter 13, where we're finishing up tonight, remember what we had just looked at last time, the wall being dedicated, had been completed. Back in chapter 10, they had made a covenant, placed their seal on it. And the covenant, and I think it's important to remember this for tonight's lesson, you know, verse 30, we would not allow our daughters, our wives, to be married to the people of the land. We wouldn't take their daughters for our sons. Verse 31, we would keep the Sabbath day. You know, we were going to, verse 32, extract that one-third of a shekel for the service of the house of God. In verse 33 beginning, we were going to make sure the offerings for the priests, the Levites, were sustained. Now we come to chapter 13, and we said, not doing so well. Almost everything that they had made the covenant about, they're not doing now. And when we come to chapter 13, things that we want to see is, chapter 9, that should say 13. Oh well, that's what happens when you use the previous template. You think you've changed all the headings. There's a difficulty in establishing a time frame. I mean, verse 1 of the 13th chapter says, on that day they read from the book of Moses, and that naturally would just seem to connect with what's just gone before it. And in verse 4, it says, now before this, Eliashib. So I think this is even a little earlier than that, except you come to verse 6, and Nehemiah says, but during all this, I was not in Jerusalem. For in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, king of Babylon, I had returned to the king. Then after certain days, I obtained leave from the king, and I came to Jerusalem and discovered the evil that Elisha had done. Now, do you remember what year the story of Nehemiah started? The 20th year. So this is 12 years into the story. He said, I went back and then I returned. So what's going on here in chapter 13 is not directly connected to the dedication of the wall, as it might first appear from the on that day. What it would seem is that Nehemiah uses these words that are translated day to mean, really mean on a day, at a time, you know, at this time is the way he really uses it. And he doesn't mean that day. He means a day, a time. There came a time when this took place. So I think this is, you know, verse 6 would indicate it's about 433 BC, about 12 years after the story began. And that makes a lot more sense. You know, chapter 12 is really tied closely with the covenant they've just made, which would have been made in that first year. But now 12 years have gone by. Nehemiah's been out of the country for a little while. And things have gone in a bad direction. No longer keeping the separation. In verse 1, they're reading from the book of Moses, and they found where no Ammonite or Moabite should ever come into the assembly of God. And it gives the reason, you know, when they had hired Balaam Verse 3, they separated. Really significant. Verses 4 through 9, I'd like for us to read this one together, taking a couple of verses each. Since we always start at the front, why don't we start at the back, Steve and Adam, and we'll work our way forward there. Okay. Now, Eliashib, here it just says the priest. At the end of the chapter, verse 28, Eliashib, the high priest, probably the same guy. And back in chapter 3, we had read where Eliashib, the high priest, rose up with his brethren, the priest, built the sheep gate, and you know, read good things about him. Here we don't see good things about him. He is made this alliance with Tobiah, who's been the enemy from the very beginning. You know, we had Tobiah and Sanballat and Geshem, and this enemies, and it says that he was allied with him in the New King James. The New American Standard margin says literally close to. Elisha was close to Tobiah, and several people give this as related to. That evidently there's some kind of a marriage thing going on. Now, look at the end of the chapter. Elisha doesn't look so good in this chapter. Verse 28, and one of the sons of Joiada, the son of Elisha the high priest, was a son-in-law of Sanballat the Horonite. Therefore I drove him from me. So, by marriage, he's tied in with another one of the enemies of Israel. This is not good. And if I say Israel, and you say, well, really this is Judah, isn't it? Well, I will rest my defense that Ezekiel, once Israel is taken into captivity, he sometimes calls them Israel. So, I mean to say Judah most of the time, but this is bad. And here, look at what is happening. Here is a room in the temple in which offerings, tithes are supposed to be kept. And Elisha cleared all that out and told one of the enemies, come in, you can have, it would seem to be like an apartment there. 8 refers to household goods. And Nehemiah comes in and says, no, we're not putting up with this. Not in the house of God. And he, verse 8, it grieved him bitterly. So he threw it all out, commanded the rooms to be cleansed, and brought the things back in. You know, here, what you have in these few verses is a contrasting study in leadership. Eliashib was a leader who completely failed. He didn't maintain the separation God expected. He made alliances with the enemies. On the other hand, Nehemiah, he took charge of things and got it back the way it was supposed to be. I don't know that Elisha was the one that was directly married into it. It could have been another family member like we saw later in the chapter with his grandson. But he was a compromiser. And that would not do. All right, anybody else anything before we move on to the next section. Look at verse 10. We're going to see another problem. Remember back in chapter 12, 44 through 47, that it talks about the offerings. And at the end of verse 44, Judah rejoiced over the priests and Levites who ministered. And it talks about them bringing in the offerings. Well, just remember that. And read. Let's read 10 through, this says 13. Let's go 10 through 14, wherever we left off, Nate. Again, I mean, verse 10, the Levites and singers, they're back out in the fields working. You know, they were not able to devote themselves to the service of the temple, to the leading in the worship there, because they're out having to work. And notice in verse 11 something that Nehemiah does. He contended with the rulers. You know, here is, you know, like the top leader, but the first one he looks to are those who would be in positions of leadership, maybe below him, but they are men of influence. Look a little later in this same chapter, in verse 17. This, we'll get to this in a moment about the Sabbath. Then I contended with the nobles of Judah. Nehemiah seeks to influence every single person in Judah. But the way he often does it, as we see here, is, okay, I can't go to every house. I can't see every person. But he gets together those people who would have influence. You know, the leaders. You remember how Moses talked about the leaders of tens and hundreds and thousands? And, you know, he breaks down and he charges them. And he's pretty harsh with them. And what happens? Well, they start, Judah brought the tithe. Notice verse 12. Then all Judah brought the tithe. He charged the rulers. And the implication would be, then they went out and they did their job. And they got other people going. And it got done. And again, verse 13, you see that organization of Nehemiah. He appointed his treasurers. And I was glad Brother Hutchison had to read those names and not me. But he organized it. He took care of it. And you have his little prayer again in verse 14. Nehemiah didn't like the house of God being neglected. The worship was not being provided for because of their failures in this. And that didn't make him happy. And he took charge. He got it done. All right, the next section has to do with the Sabbath. And let's read this. It doesn't take that long. 15 through 22.
Thank you.
Oh, okay. Look at, you know, he just gives a description of all the kinds of things going on Sabbath day. And there were people coming in from other places selling. And I notice again, what I just said, verse 17, he contended with the nobles. And then he reminds them, he said, look, this is what brought God's wrath on us before. You know, it wasn't, you know, we tend to think just of the idolatry. But Jeremiah 17 in particular is a passage that Jeremiah 17, 27, thereabouts, that focuses on their violation of the Sabbath. And at the end of 2 Chronicles 36, it talks about the land keeping the Sabbath. That they had violated this. And he said, you know, he's reminding them of history, maybe of the Scripture. I mean, obviously the Scripture said keep the Sabbath, but he may be reminding them of some of the what some of the prophets said. And so, as Nehemiah so often does, he doesn't just talk. He said, there's something we can do. He said, we can shut these gates at dark. It starts getting dark on, we'd call it Friday evening, they shut the gates. He said, we'll open it back up when the time comes. And he posted some guards. Now, there were these merchants and sellers. Verse 16 indicated that they were, many of them came from Tyre, Phoenician city up to the north. And he warned them. And he said, look, if I have to, I'll lay hands on you. You know, the expression lay hands on someone is used in a lot of different ways. You know, you lay hands on someone to appoint them to an office. You lay hands on somebody to arrest them. And I think that he's saying, look, we're gonna lay hands on you. We're gonna punish you. And so they got rid of them. And he told the Levites, verse 22, you get out there and you guard these gates. We are going to sanctify the Sabbath day. Because God said do it. You know, Nehemiah is just not, I mean, he is concerned for doing what's right. He came back to rebuild the wall. The wall's been built. But he's concerned about their relationship with God and their disobedience to God. And do you see how we're just seeing each thing that they'd promised not to do, they're doing? You know, they said, you know, we're going to bring our tithes and offerings in. No, they didn't. You know, we're going to keep the Sabbath day. No, they weren't. And they said, we're not going to give our daughters, take their daughters for our sons? Well, yes, they do. That's what the next section, 23 through 27. Well, let's go 23 through 28. David, one of y'all. All right. Jews had married women of Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab. You know, this is something God had warned about, had forbidden. Deuteronomy 7, which is quoted in 1 Kings 11. And, you know, and I think that there's a real, though he does not quote it in exactness, it would seem that Nehemiah has familiarity with 1 Kings. That, I mean, he knows the historic events, but the way 1 Kings 11 reads, it would seem that he is referencing that, and he is upset. I mean, he said, your children can't even speak the language. You know, they're not speaking, they're speaking the language of Ashdod, the Philistines, which, you know, Ashdod, that would, that is the Philistine city. And then, whoo, he got worked up, didn't he? You know, a little humorous aside here. I thought it was funny. Steve Casebolt might not have thought it quite as funny. I don't know if any of you know Steve Casebolt, but we were in the congregation together down at Beulah, in Coleman County, Beulah. And talk about different styles and temperaments. And, you know, and I joke, when Ezra, the same problem, what did it cause Ezra to do? It said he pulled out some of his hair and his beard, and then Nehemiah pulled out some of their hair. And I just kind of made, I mean, I was joking. I said, you know, Steve is probably more one of the Ezra types, and I'm a Nehemiah. And Steve said, you mean because I pulled out all my own hair? I wasn't even thinking about all I was thinking about. You know, it'd be more like me to grab somebody else's hair and yank it out. But Steve didn't have much left. And but obviously, it would not be proper for one of us to grab somebody and start yanking their hair out today. But I do think that sometimes we ought to get a little more worked up about some things than we do. That there are things that ought to upset us. Not in a personal anger. I mean, they've not personally offended Nehemiah. And when it said he cursed them, obviously he's not saying, you know, dirty words against them. As the margin says, he pronounced them cursed. You know, he reminds them, I suspect it was, he reminded them that covenant. We made a promise before God. I mean, not only are we breaking the commandment of Deuteronomy 7, we entered a covenant in which we put our names on this thing. And we said, you're bringing down the wrath of God on yourself. He was some were upset. And then, like I say, he took them back historically, scripturally, to Solomon. And look at how he words, there was no king like him. He was beloved of his God. Nevertheless, pagan women caused even him to sin. What was the one gift that God blessed Solomon with above all else? Wisdom. A man that wise was led astray. And he said, I don't want to hear about this. Now,
such a thing as being jealous for the law of God, and if you contend for the faith, such a thing as contending for the faith. Mm-hmm. And if you do it in the right spirit and with the right purpose in mind, it's always a good thing to do that. You don't let things that are contrary to the progress of righteousness in the congregation to continue on and on without saying something about it. Because you stand, you always stand up for truth. Mm-hmm. And appreciate that in Nehemiah and this
it worked, didn't it? Yeah, that did. This is a fiery zeal. And now, the one thing that's interesting comparing this to Ezra 10, it doesn't specifically say that he demanded their separation. Though it's hard to imagine that they heard all these words and they said, oh, all we got to do is say, I'm sorry, and we can go back and you know, keep on. So I think, you know, we have that. And then we have this son of Eliashib. Well, one of the sons of Joiada, the son of Eliashib, which, if I'm understanding that right, means it was the grandson, was a son-in-law of Sanballat. I drove him before me, and he said, verse 29, they have defiled the priesthood. God gave them a special place, and they've defiled it. There were serious issues. The last part of this talked about more separation. But to get to our actual leadership lessons, I'm not going to go through those last because it's the same thing we've covered, basically. Anybody thoughts before we start hitting my bullet points? When is the right time? And I can't know, but it may well be that Nehemiah is thinking, you know, we went through this. Now, if the chronology is as I understand it, it had been about 25 years since Ezra had come back. You know, and some time had passed, but only 12 years before this, they had made a covenant. And that may be why Nehemiah doesn't take the old, well, I'm going to say, maybe felt like at this point, I'm not going to shame them, you know, by just sitting here crying. But there are different approaches for different times for the same kind of thing. Yeah, that's exactly. And that's a real failure of a leader there. Very good, for sure. Oh, I didn't mean to hit that click. I already pulled it up. I'm ahead of myself. So ready. Leadership lessons. We've really already hit at some of these, but one of the things that just really, as I was reading, it struck me is leaders need to realize the same battles sometimes have to be fought again. One of the greatest mistakes I think made in churches is to think, hey, we talked about that 5 years ago. You know, preachers, oh, I preached on that a couple of years ago. Yeah, you know, that's, if you've got a normal congregation, what's a normal congregation? You know, in your typical group, you know, you've got children growing up all the time. What a 10-year-old understands is so much different than what that same person will understand at 12 or 13. Same way, a 15-year-old, an 18-year-old. You know, and people forget things. And then hopefully there are conversions. You know, people forget, new pressures arise. Sometimes you've dealt with issues and everybody seems solid. And then some new pressure arises. And you better teach again. You better better be willing. And hopefully we do preemptive fighting. You know, as we teach and people are prepared ahead of time. In the book, Preaching in a Changing World, which Urban Lee wrote back, I think 1975 or somewhere down in there, he became a Christian as the Missionary Society instrumental music issues were still sort of being fought out, but were about resolved. As he said, when he began preaching, we didn't talk much about the Missionary Society because, hey, that issue had been settled. The folks believed in the Missionary Society, they went over here to the Christian church. And there we were. And he said, you know, in general, we didn't teach much about it. And as he said, when institutionalism came along, questions about the college and the orphan's home, it was just the Missionary Society rebranded. But he said, we hadn't taught on it. Because that was a resolved issue. So be careful of that. That's something to be aware of. And then leaders can be compromised by bad alliances. We focused on Nehemiah. Elisha was a leader. In fact, he would have been the highest ranking spiritual leader in Judah. You know, they had no king. Nehemiah was appointed as governor. And he makes these bad alliances. And you know, leaders need to be, all of us need to be careful. That's true. That is so true. That is so true. Well, something else and maybe I'm reading things that are too much, but the fact, 13:8, it said it grieved me bitterly. But, you know, how did this affect Nehemiah directly? It had been easy to say, well, I sure wish old Elisha hadn't done that, but after all, I mean, he's the high priest in the temple. He's in charge of that. He was concerned about things. He took it seriously. But, as I said last week, Nehemiah was not the kind to say, well, that's a bad thing, and I wish it hadn't happened, and just kind of wring his hands and say, nothing I can do about it. You know, he cleaned house. I deliberate play on words there. Hope y'all caught that. You know, he cleaned house. He took care of things. There's a time for grieving and there's a time for action. And, you know, in the bullet points that I've given you, which, by the way, what you have on this other sheet, minus the yellow highlighting, is the ones from all the other lessons, but they're reworked a little bit. You know, each week I would just give what we had done from the week before, I'd give to you, and I've combined these down, it's about the fifth one down. I've got, he didn't rush into it. You know, there's talked about early in this that, you know, you don't want to be guilty of the paralysis by analysis where you think and you think and you think and you never act. Don't rush into things. But we can't sit and plan forever. We can't sit and talk about, well, we wish something were done. Sometimes we have to do things. And Nehemiah took action. He acted. I mean, you think about the things he did. He rebuked them. He verbally rebuked them. He organized when he saw the house of God being neglected. Next point, actually, you know, it's separate. But he acted to see that things were done. And he made some organization. And when it came to the Sabbath, very similar, it bothered him. He saw this and he was upset about it. And he cited history. He cited scripture. And he took some steps. He closed the gates. He was willing to use his authority if he had to. And I don't think I included this one, but I should have, what I said earlier. Nehemiah, he wanted everybody to be on board. But he went through leaders. That was the most effective way in this case. The last one I want to get to, and then I'll open it up. The intermarriages. Sin ought to bother us. And we've all, I'm sure, have had this experience where there's something that's said that we just kind of get a, I don't like that, but I can't put my finger on why it bothers me. There are going to be those situations, and if it's, well, me personally, then, if my conscience is not clear, I back up, but it's hard to go to somebody and say, I don't like what you're doing. And they say, well, why? Well, I don't know. I just kind of get a bad feeling about it. That's Nehemiah in this case. He didn't go to them and say, I'm not real comfortable with this, but I don't know why. He told them why. He knew, he understood, and he, laid it on them with plainness. And I think, if we're going to be effective, we need to know how to communicate and how to express it. That's Nehemiah. We've got some time remaining. I want to go back and review a few of the main leadership points, just because as we've gone through, we haven't reviewed a lot. But also, if there's anything in chapter 13, I want you to feel free to express that, ask something, whatever. I think you're right. There are two cautions I would offer. One, and I think you're being told, feelings have to be guided by the facts. In this case, it was with Nehemiah. It was a fact. And whatever, whether it be joy, the eunuch went on his way rejoicing because the fact he'd been saved. And we have, when the facts are there, there ought to be joy, there'd be sorrow. Make sure the facts control the feelings, not the other way around. We get a feeling, and so then we think something's a fact because I felt this way. Make sure you get it in the right order. The second thing is, sometimes people are more emotional than I realize. You know, their feeling may be stronger. I'm not going to judge. You know, some people cry over anything and everything. It may not be that genuine. There may be people who never shed a tear but are heartbroken and genuinely, you know. And I'm not saying we shouldn't be willing. I would offer that as a caution, and yet at the same time say, the instruction to do things decently and in order should not prevent us from weeping sometimes, from rejoicing, you know, in a very clear way. And when with the thing we're talking about here about sin, it ought to, as you said, it ought to bother us a lot more than it does sometimes. In fact, instead of being entertained by it, as we sometimes are on television and movies, you know, and just, well, it's not that big a deal. It was to Nehemiah. Yeah. Nehemiah got a lot done that way. Yes, sir.
Same thing. There are a lot of people today that can tell you the story about what happened. Mm-hmm. But you want to hear all of that. Mm-hmm. You want to pick it up so that at the end of it you can say amen. Mm-hmm. And you can be a part of it. And some of the older people that are hard of hearing can also pick up on what is going on. But I realize right now I'm about to get into an area where it's very sensitive. But when the prayer is going on and you're going on and that way, somebody goes out like that,
mm-hmm.
that's distracting, very mm-hmm. distracting. And I know that somebody's going to tap me on the back of the head for doing that, but I do believe that elders have a responsibility of providing quietness and solemnity. And mothers can teach their children. They are watching out for them as much as anybody is during worship, but they put their finger up, shh.
Mm-hmm.
And that means there are consequences if you don't settle down.
Well, I think that certainly one of the things that parents are teaching children, and I think that elders and preachers and all of us need to be teaching, is that our worship should be a time of reverence, and you know, and then of course I think we also, as brethren who love one another, we have to realize that training process for parents, it's a process. It doesn't happen in one service. So, you know, it's going to take a little time to get them trained, but that's something that parents ought to start from the first day working on. But it's a process, and be patient with them while they're working their way through it. Well, I think it's a real balance of the parents need to be doing their very best to provide the quietness, but we also need to be patient with them and know that most of the time, especially if they have to get up and go out, the parent is usually embarrassed. They wish they hadn't did. So don't add by staring at them as they leave. You know, that doesn't help them. Let me go back real quickly. I want you to take the leadership points. I can't go over all of them, but I want to remind you of a few that I think, you know, that just stood out to me. The very first one about integrity. Start with character. That's where I don't care if you get everything else right. If you don't have character, the right character, you're not a Christian. You can't be a good leader. The second one, Nehemiah was concerned. He was not self-centered. We can't be thinking only of ourselves or even kind of our family. You know, we're concerned for all. He prayed. That's just so important to good leadership in the home. In the church. I mean, it's part of being a disciple, but it is important. Under the confession of sin, notice the subpoint, an expression of humility. If we think too highly of ourselves, you know, we might be able to the ship. We're not good leaders of God's people. We won't be good husbands and fathers. We won't be good. You know, we've got to be humble. He knew the Scriptures. This is about biblical leadership. You know, the kind of, a lot of what we talk about would be things that would be useful if you're, you know, managing a company, if you're, you know, superintending a school. But we're talking biblical leadership. You don't have to know the Scriptures to run a Fortune 500 company. You've got to know the Scriptures thoroughly to oversee God's people, to be the parents that you ought to be. Nehemiah was not a man who, he took time to think, didn't rush things. He took time to make a plan. And, you know, I didn't put the verses. Some of these, they came out in various places in the book. He organized. He had specifics. But understand this. You will have opposition. And one of the things that brought the opposition was his success. Years ago, Brother J.D. Tant sent a, back in those days, the Gospel Advocate was the paper that was read by brethren all over the country. That was before it went so liberal. But it was common for preachers to send reports into the magazine. And there was Brother Tant one time wrote, story said, he said, the devil has not been seen in it. He named such and such county in 10 years. You know, that's an opening line, isn't it? And then he said, the such and such Church of Christ is doing his work for him. Well, I'm not saying Brother Tant should have, you know, the old Brother J.D. Tant, now he was quite the character, should have sent that in. But the devil, you know, he'll leave us alone if we're not doing anything. But if we are working, striving to teach the truth, there will be problems. And so know that. Don't let the opposition stop the work. Don't be worn down by it. At the bottom of the page, he showed leaders, particularly within the church, you're going to have to know what you can share and what you can't. Look at the third one down. When they went to build the walls, he gave, this is on the second page, third one down, gave the people reason to believe they could be successful. You know, you've got that people, what they can do. You've got to know the Scriptures. One, make sure what we're even thinking about doing is right. But part of leadership is convincing people they can do things they didn't think they could do. But the thing is, sometimes maybe they can't do it. Sometimes a man thinks he can't do something because he can't do it. But so often, leaders are able to look at it and say, no. And they explain the obstacle. They get them going. And very much related to that, 2 points down, those whom you lead may become weary and are discouraged, and you must help them. You know, there was that time they said, there's just too much. You know, the wall, the stones are burnt. You know, Nehemiah kept them going. Three down from that. Don't ignore internal problems. Last night in the auditorium class, talking about Acts 20, Paul's address to the Ephesian elders. He said, grievous wolves are going to come in among you, not sparing the flock. Then he said, also from among yourselves, men will rise up. Realize there will be opposition from within and from without. Down 2 points now, he got everyone involved. You know, you notice there were times he designated certain for certain jobs. He put them, he knew, you know, he had to put this guy over the storehouse. He had to have, but largely through this, you see him getting everybody. And somewhere in all of this, oh, down much later, I've got, he delegated responsibilities. One of the failures, sometimes in leadership, is, and this is one of those things, it can be successful at the beginning and for a while, but it won't last, is leaders that do everything. You know, they want to make sure this job's done right, so they do it. And they do, and then in time, they just burn out. Sometimes, usually it's both, they end up, what they're doing is leading a bunch of complacent people who've not become involved. You know, that, you know, there are jobs that you give to everybody. And then I'm not talking, and don't insult people by giving them busy work. You know, just, you know, a job that doesn't mean anything at all. But there are things to do, and people in the spiritual kingdom need to be busy. You know, there are a lot of other, right below that, he did not lead for personal gain. It wasn't about Nehemiah. He was, to borrow the words of Jesus, he was as wise as a serpent. He was also courageous. And the very last one, the last few, of course, are taken from tonight. Don't live in the past, but do learn from history. I want to tell you that's one of the more challenging lessons I think we ever face. You talk to a church, you say, why don't we do something? Well, we did that before, you know. Didn't work. Okay, well, you know, it didn't work 25 years ago, so let's don't ever think about trying it again. You know, it didn't work. Or on the other hand, there'll be somebody say, oh, you know, back when I was younger, everything was so wonderful. And, you know, we remember, you know, I mean, I remember when I was younger, I was playing baseball. I batted 1,500, you know, 1,000's the best you can do, but I batted 1,500, you know. As time goes by, our memories tend to embellish past accomplishments. And sometimes churches, I mean, it works both ways. They dwell on past failures or past accomplishments. And they can't move past. And learn from both of those. Maybe that is something that just doesn't work. Or maybe we just need to do it differently this time. Well, look at that past success. What can we learn from that? You know, time, maybe circumstances are a little different. Times have changed. But what can we learn? Learn from the past, but you have to live in the present with an eye on the future. That's the way we have to live. The ones that I highlighted are not the only important ones, I hope. But they were some of the ones I wanted to get back over, make sure we did and reviewed again. I hope this has been helpful to you. I know for myself, it's given me a better understanding of some principles, and now I've got to learn to live them and apply them. And there are some of these that I really need to do better about. And if this was nothing but a review for you, then congratulations. But if you've learned some new things, let's work on applying them and planning. And I especially want to say to the younger ones, be a leader right now in a home, wherever you may be, but have that vision of the eldership. That's one of the things we want to point toward, is growing elders. You know, generation after generation of them. You know, that sometimes churches go years and years without it. Well, that's not a failure of one generation. That's a failure of many.
What do you think about you have young men in the congregation? They're not old enough to be elders, right?
Anybody else? Anything? We're running past our time tonight. I've done pretty good this, you know, in these five classes of getting pretty close to eight. Well, I appreciate so much you being part of this. I remind you, these have been recorded, and they're available on the member side. They're not out on the general side, but they're on the website. You could also probably convince John Michael to give you a CD if you needed it, or maybe somebody else can burn it. I don't burn CDs, but I'm not capable, but I've refused to ask how to do it. no, they are available if you want to go back through them, and as far as I'm concerned, share them with somebody else if they would want to have it. But I do appreciate you being part of this. Rodney, would you lead us in prayer, and then we'll be